This is Philosophy Bites with me, Nigel Warburton.
And me, David Edmonds.
If you enjoy Philosophy Bites, please support us. We're currently unfunded and all donations would be gratefully received. For details, go to www.philosophybites.com.
What, if anything, does morality have to do with accountability? According to Stephen Darwell of Yale University, the two are inextricable.
Stephen Darwell, welcome to Philosophy Bites.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
The topic we're going to focus on is moral accountability. Could we just start by outlining what accountability is in this area?
Well, by accountability, I mean something in the region of what Peter Strawson in his famous article, Freedom and Resentment, was talking about when he talked about a distinctive kind of responsibility. The point is that accountability is always to someone or other. My claims have to do with the role of accountability in the concepts of moral obligation, moral rights, and so on. And the thought is that these notions can't be understood except in terms of what it is to hold oneself accountable to others and hold others accountable to one, and that this is always, as I call it, a second personal relation. It always involves an implicit address to oneself or to others as a you.
Could you give an example of this? If I've understood you correctly, what you're saying is that to understand moral obligation, you have to recognize that at its core there is some sort of relationship between the person who's accountable and another person.
Right. In some cases, the accountability is indeed to the person that one is relating to. So one person stepping on another person's foot. I got the example from Hume's treatise and also from Nagel's Possibility of Altruism. Okay, so if I step on your foot, I wrong you, and I do something that's wrong. As I analyze it, in wronging you, I do something that you have justification. Indeed, anybody has justification. I have justification for blaming myself for doing if I didn't have any excuse for doing that. So in that case, I'm accountable to any, as I think of it, member of the moral community. But there's another way of thinking about this too, which is I don't just do something wrong, I wrong you. And in wronging you, I'm accountable to you as the victim of my wrongdoing in a way that I'm not accountable to others or to myself as the perpetrator. So you would naturally feel resentment, perhaps. And in feeling resentment, you would see yourself as having some standing or authority to address a claim or demand to me to get off of your foot, to object. So you have a standing to object that other people don't have. You also have a standing to forgive me if I take responsibility and you have it in your heart to forgive me. Other people don't have the standing to forgive me. So there's both the kind of accountability we have to specific individuals, as in this case, but then I think there's always in play as well a kind of accountability we have to anyone, indeed to ourselves as well, just as members of the moral community.
Now, you mentioned Peter Strawson and his notion of reactive attitude.
Right.
That's a very famous paper, Freedom and Resentment. I wonder if you could just unpack a bit what he said so we get clear about which aspect of that you're drawing attention to.
So the crucial point about reactive attitudes is that they are held from a distinctive perspective and they involve a distinctive way of seeing and, most importantly, relating to their objects. So Strawson says they're felt from an interpersonal perspective. I use the term second personal to highlight the grammatical, logical structure of the attitudes as always involving an implicit address. When you feel blame, or if when you feel resentment or indignation, or indeed if you feel guilt, it's to you as if someone, either someone else or oneself, has violated some kind of legitimate demand. So that's the first point, that reactive attitudes always implicitly address a demand to their objects. And they also bid for the recognition of the legitimacy of the demand. They come with what I call an RSVP. Unlike other attitudes, which may be quite critical, these attitudes are engaging attitudes. They look the other in the eye with the intent to have the other look back and engage one. Unlike, say, contempt or disdain, where if there is a looking aspect, they look at the other not so that the other will engage and look back, but so that the other will look down.
And these attitudes, are they part of a cultural arrangement because we've been brought up that way?
They certainly are realized in cultures, but I don't think they're just cultural artifacts. I think they're deep features of human psychology, and they play a functional role that would have to be part of the psychology of any being who is capable of being subject to moral obligations, that is, a moral agent or a moral subject. The distinctive human contours of blame and of resentment and guilt needn't be there, let's say, for some imaginable moral subjects. But any moral subject would have to have the capacity to take a standpoint in relation to himself, address himself, and make a demand of himself, hold himself accountable for any being that's capable of morality.
We've been talking about accountability, but some people would see this entirely in terms of considering other people's interests, in the sense that you couldn't be moral if you were a psychopath who only had your own interests at heart.
Right. There's a difference between considering other people's interest or interests just as, let's say, what would be good for them, where you yourself have a view about what would be good for them, and you act out of concern for them. That's an old idea. In my view, it's not what's distinctive about morality. So another way of thinking about morality is not just responding to what's good for someone, but also responding to what they themselves take an interest in. So that's actually responding to their perspective. In the first kind of case, we have our perspective on them and say, this would be good for you, I'll do it out of the goodness of my heart or because it's noble to do it or whatever. But once you have the idea that they and what they want and what their values are make a claim on one, and that they're in a position to ask us to do things or to make claims on us, then I think you've got a very different notion. There you've got the idea that the other has a kind of moral voice and that we, in a way, are responsible to that voice, and we have a fundamental kind of accountability to them as they do to us.
The other aspect of this that's coming out in our conversation is the two-way nature of this. It's not a serve and volley, it's a rally.
Exactly right. Let's just say you're rallying before the match, let's say in tennis. Of course, once we start the match, then the idea is to hit it where the other person can't hit it back. But when we're rallying, we're just hitting it to each other, and what we're trying to do is to keep it going back and forth. But the crucial point is this reciprocal character of the relation. And all second personal relations have a fundamental reciprocity built into them. You're speaking to someone or you're making a claim of someone and you're implicitly bidding for their recognition of it's being okay to make that claim and in responding in various ways.
What if the other person in this moral conversation has crazy assumptions and so expects something unreasonable, completely unreasonable from you?
Well, so the idea of morality is built on the idea of reasonable expectations, what people can warrantedly expect. The fact that people expect something in particular doesn't itself entail anything about whether you're under any moral obligation to do it. We do, I think, have a fundamental moral obligation to listen to others and to take their actual claims seriously, but we're only obligated to do what people justifiably demand of us. Alongside our practices of holding ourselves to these norms, there is the moral conversation of what is it exactly that we can hold each other to. And that just is the conversation about what morality requires of us.
Does it follow from your account of accountability that there are some people who are outside the moral realm?
If there are people who lack what I call second personal competence, that is, the capacity to put themselves in another person's shoes, view themselves from that perspective, and regulate their view by a more or less impartial consideration of the relevant facts, interests, and so on, then they may not be able to hold themselves accountable. And if they're not able to hold themselves accountable, then it's unintelligible for us to hold them accountable. That doesn't mean that we can't, as a way of protecting ourselves, defend ourselves from them in various ways, but we shouldn't fool ourselves into thinking that we're actually holding them accountable for what they're doing. We can intelligibly hold them accountable only if we take them to be capable of holding themselves accountable.
Does what you're saying apply beyond morality? Does it go into the realm of the law, for instance?
Well, I think of the law as a set of human practices that make use of certain notions, like the notion of authority and the notion of guilt and the notion of innocence. They're just these fundamental moral notions. So we have the idea of a legal obligation. A legal obligation isn't the same as a moral obligation. Nonetheless, in order for it to be a legal obligation, it's got to be an obligation that follows from some set of statutes or from law, where the law itself purports to have a kind of de jure authority over us. Now, it may not have it. It may just be de facto authority, but it purports to have de jure authority. And as I view it, that's not really different fundamentally from moral authority. So it is no accident that the first great work of international law, Hugo Grotius's The Law or Rights of War and Peace, depending on which translator you like, is also, to my mind, one of the first to begin to work up this modern notion of morality as a set of norms that any being capable of what Grotius called sociability is under, distinctive obligations that involve a kind of accountability.
There are allegedly cultures which are driven not by guilt and blame, but by shame. Do they fit into this framework as well?
Guilt, as I analyze it, is second personal and a reactive attitude in Strawson's sense because it involves this implicit address to oneself. The natural ways of expressing guilt are to apologize, to engage the other, to try to make amends, to promise to change and never to do it again, and so on. Shame is a very different response. An important point about shame is that the things that one does feel shame for don't necessarily have to involve moral offenses. So when I was in high school, I felt shame for my pimply face. But that's different from the thought that I really should have done something to change my pimply face. I might have thought, oh, there's nothing I could have done to change my pimply face. Now, we don't think that that was justified shame. But there are even cases where there's justified shame that has nothing to do with morality. So let's say, as a philosopher, I aim for a certain standard of quality in my arguments and a certain commitment to the subject and so on. And here, that could be an actual performance, could be an occasion for shame, but not the thought that I had violated some kind of moral obligation. The natural expressions of shame are also not to engage the other. The natural expression of shame is to hide one's face, to disappear from view, and so on. So shame is very unlike guilt in not having this essentially second personal structure. If I'm right that accountability is essentially second personal, then shame is not essentially related to accountability. Is it possible for there to be shame cultures that don't have the notion of guilt at all, and hence, as I'm analyzing, don't have the idea of moral right and wrong? Sure.
Do you think that having this notion of guilt and blame is an advance for humanity, or were we better off with an honor culture?
I do think that the idea of guilt and the moral notions, the idea of moral obligation and moral right and wrong that I'm arguing is tied to that idea, is an advance. And one way to see that, I think, is the deep connection between the idea of human rights and the idea of morality. It is no accident that Hugo Grotius, Pufendorf, the early modern natural lawyers, are simultaneously working up a notion of rights that any person is in a position to claim, but at the same time articulating the idea of morality, that is, the idea of norms that we are all obligated to comply with. The idea of a right, as I analyze it, is also tied to accountability. A right is something that the right holder is in a distinctive position to hold those against whom she holds the right accountable for complying with. So there couldn't be human rights without morality, and there couldn't be either without the idea of justified holding responsible attitudes like guilt, for example.
Does this notion of moral accountability restrict itself to situations which are essentially social? Say I chopped down a tree in the middle of the Amazon and nobody heard, and there's no visible effect on anybody directly from that tree falling. Is that outside morality?
So in my view, it's certainly not necessarily outside morality. And in my own normative view, it's not outside morality. So how are we to understand it? Well, we're just talking about the intertwining between human rights and morality. This would be a case in which no one's right is violated. So I don't wrong any person, certainly. But to think that it's wrong to cut down the tree, we just have to think that any member of the moral community would warrantedly blame cutting down the tree were someone to do that without excuse. So even if the idea of moral obligation is tied to these distinctive attitudes that only beings of a certain kind can have, that doesn't mean that the objects of these attitudes must always be violations of persons. There can be violations of other kinds of norms, not connected to persons in that way.
Accountability, as you've described it, is about a kind of moral conversation. And it seems to me that some people are better at conversation than other people. Is it also true that some people are better at morality than other people?
Well, it's possible to be quite a good person, a quite morally good person, even if you're quite poor at conversation. So you might be very shy, for example. To do what's right, you just have to be able to do what would emerge out of the conversation of the right kind with such a person. So you have to comply with what would be a reasonable demand of you. Now, for most of us, the only way we can get a clear sense of what demands are reasonable of us is to be part of the human conversation. But we do that through literature, we do that through reading in the newspaper, we do that through all kinds of interaction with one another, in addition to conversation, though conversation is obviously a very important part of it.
Stephen Dowell, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. I've really enjoyed it.
For more Philosophy Bites, go to www.philosophybites.com. You can also find details there of Philosophy Bites books and how to support us.